I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Mohamed El-Sheikhi grew up in Libya, living under what he calls the casual dictatorship of Muammar Gaddafi. He survived the revolution, worked as a translator, went to medical school for a few years, co-hosted a radio show that got his station burned down, came to the U.S. to study under a State Department program, and just last year was granted asylum because of the dangers he would face in Libya. He's been living in Portland, Oregon since 2014. That is the circuitous route Mohamed El-Sheikhi took to stand-up comedy, the surprise result of a public speaking class. Here's a clip from a performance at the Helium Comedy Club in Portland last year.
My name is Mohamed, that's my name. I am an immigrant, and it's super weird being an immigrant now in this country. I don't know if you've been watching the news lately for the past 20 years. But also it's weird being an immigrant here in Portland specifically, because everyone here has a sign next to their door that reads something like, "Immigrants are welcome here." And I want to test that so bad. I just want to open someone's front door and be like, "Well, I am here." Yeah, thank you. "Is that the kitchen? Cool, go make me something. I'll wait here, yeah. Seasoning, please, yeah."
White people, Mohamed El-Sheikhi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We got a big kick out of that, I have to say. That's very fun. Nice to have you with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So where to start? I actually think we should start by talking about radio, your career on radio, because here, obviously, we are talking on radio. What was your show about?
My show, we didn't really have like a specific topic. We would just like pick one, anything that has been happening lately, and we just like kind of riff on it for two hours. We did that for like three times a week.
And we meaning you had a co-host.
I did. I did have a co-host, yeah. And the main purpose the show was for was, first it was all in English. We didn't do it in Arabic because the goal was to reach people who did not live in Libya. So we streamed it online on the internet so like people like can listen to it, because we felt that there's been a lot of like media coverage about Libya. And obviously it doesn't really kind of like translates to people, and some of it, like, there's a lot of missing parts, so like we want to like provide that like missing part to people. And we had so many people listen to it from abroad, like, yeah. And we get Skype calls and talk to people, get their questions and whatnot. We obviously also broadcasted in like Libya as well, and people like could listen to it, which got mixed reactions because we went wild with it. We just talk about anything we want, and some of the topics we kind of like talked about were kind of like topics that people were not comfortable talking about yet.
And this was, shortly after the revolution or in the throes of the revolution?
It was
depending on what you define as revolution,
exactly,
right?
Absolutely. We actually started the show during the revolution, like 2 months in. And then we went for maybe like a year and a half. The revolution ended, and then there was like a transitional period and all of that, and we were still doing the show. And yeah.
What was the show called?
It was called Tribute FM. That's what we called it. Yeah.
You got not just hate mail. I think anyone that's on the radio or on TV, you get hate mail. You just get used to that. But you got death threats.
Yeah, we did get a lot of death threats. Me and my co-host, we either get them. At first, we only got them on the cell phone, and I was like, okay, that makes sense. We have the phone number out there. Then I started getting them on my phone number.
Your personal phone
exactly,
number.
Yeah. And then like my Facebook and like.
Now you're smiling while you're saying this.
I am, and I did even at the time, because like I was like 20, 21, and all of that was exciting for me. Like even getting there, just like felt like a thrill. I'm like, oh, I'm actually doing something that, even like if people hate it, it is something. And it didn't really matter to me. I'm like, ah, death row, who cares? Like, it's just, which I think about it now, and I'm like, oh, that was kind of dumb.
Well, the radio station did get burned down, right?
It did.
Because of you and your co-host?
Yes, for the most part.
Was it something specific you said, or was it just the cumulative effect of being on the air?
I think it was a lot of stuff, but I think the episode that we got a lot of hate for the most, we were talking about like the new face of the government and what that is going to be like and all of that, and we talked about the idea of having like a secular government, like religion is something that's only practiced inside the mosque and that's it. It doesn't really apply to the new constitution or any of that. And people just didn't like that. People like, no, we have to get the laws from religion. And it was just like, we didn't really even have that in the past. So why have it now?
Well, I don't think of Gaddafi as a particularly religious person.
Not at all. No, not at all. So it was like that weird thing where people like, no, you don't talk about religion now. And part of it was like during the revolution, all of these like very extreme religious people came from their hideouts and they were like became more vocal at that point. And it wasn't something that we were used to.
Was radio or is radio a good way to learn to be a stand-up comic?
Absolutely.
I mean, you don't get the visuals, obviously, but there's so much you can do with a voice.
Absolutely, yeah.
Writing.
Exactly, yeah, because it made me kind of like think on the spot, like of like funny stuff to say and all of that. And that's what we did. Like if you go back and listen to the show, it was like mostly like very like just like a lot of humor, even with like
you were 21 years old, right?
Exactly, yeah. We were just having fun. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
Now, you grew up in Benghazi.
I did, yes.
And your mom is still, she was a teacher, now she's a school principal. Your dad, a business guy.
That is correct, yes.
And you have a couple of siblings?
I do actually have four siblings.
Four siblings.
Yes, and I'm the oldest. I have three brothers and one sister.
I mean, would you say that was a pretty middle class life you had growing up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we lived well. Like, both of my parents worked, and we had a house that we owned and everything, and for the first years of school, I went to a private school, and I was one of the few people who actually like was able to afford to go to a school that thought English as a second language and like thought it well, and like had like teachers from abroad who came and taught it in schools and stuff. So yeah, I would say, I mean, I did have a good life growing up.
Were you a funny kid?
I think I was. I like to think that I used to do the thing growing up when I used to kind of like write plays or whatever and then make my siblings act in them and do it in front of my family. And I don't know if they were nice about it and laughed or they actually liked it, but who knows?
You, in one of your stand-up, you talk about the, and I quoted you, the casual dictatorship of Muammar Gaddafi. I thought that was an interesting way, and perhaps in hindsight,
maybe
it looks more casual than what's happening in Libya today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was casual because, like, you didn't really think about it. Like, Gaddafi was not someone I thought about until the revolution, to be honest. Or I would say until the social media. Yeah, because before that, it was just, like, very normal to live under him. And the main rule was, like, as long as you don't speak about the government or about him, you're okay. So, yeah, we don't really think about him. Like, in my mind, he was like, okay, once he dies, then his son will become the president, and it's fine, whatever, who cares. But, yeah, and not until, the social media, like, when I feel like a lot of people, like, got, like a taste of what it was outside of the borders of Libya. And then it was like, oh, people live that way?
Oh, interesting.
Oh, okay.
Is there kind of a nostalgia? I know we hear about that in Iraq, the kind of nostalgia for Saddam Hussein when you kind of knew what was what.
I mean, in Libya, yes, people do. I think people don't miss him. They miss the safety. Or they miss, at least it was like, it was a bad thing happening back then, but it was like the same kind of bad every day. And people like they can live, they can go to school, they can make money, they can do all of that as long as they keep a distance. But now it feels like there are no rules to protect yourself. It's just like you wake up every day and like, okay, here's another day, here we go. I have no idea who to keep away from. And there are so many rival groups. At least with Gaddafi, you had like one enemy. When now it's just like, yeah, and people have different opinions, and now they're kind of like broke families and friends and all of that. So it's kind of like,
a jungle. You have to pick a side, right?
Exactly.
When the sides are constantly shifting.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes.
You have a funny bit about how you did go to medical school for a while because your parents decided that that was your dream in life, right?
Yeah. They were like, yeah, I remember I finished high school and they were like, you always wanted to be a doctor. And I was like, did I? And they were like, yeah, since you were four, you wouldn't stop talking about it. I'm like, I don't think that's true. But they're like, yeah, you got to pick this or become an engineer. There's like, I'm like, I'm sure there's like other things I can do. They're like, nope.
Nope. That's it?
Yeah, and my brother went to like engineering school, and he did actually like it. Well, I went to med school for 4 years, and then I dropped out because I just—
Did you hate it?
I hated it. Like, I never hated something as much. I wasn't interested, and I can tell that it wasn't for me just because looking at people around me, my friends and stuff who went to med school because they actually liked it, they were doing really well because they enjoyed it. And I'm like, I just can't do this. Like, I'm just passing. That's what I'm doing. Yeah.
So what do they think, your parents think of you being a stand-up comedian?
They
wasn't exactly in the cards for them, right?
Absolutely. Well, the thing is, like, before I became a stand-up comedian and while I was a stand-up comedian, I was in business school. And the thing with my parents is, as long as I went to college and I got my degree, that's good for them. And so I got my degree, and then they were like, what are you doing with your degree? I'm like, I'm running me as a business.
That's the line?
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, I don't think that you're doing it. I'm like, no, I'm absolutely using all of the skills I learned in school, and I'm growing me as a product and a business. And they were like, okay, well, as long as you're making money. And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, it's yeah.
Well, it helps they live in Tripoli and you're in Portland, right?
Exactly. Yeah, like, no, I'm doing really well.
Well, you did, and this was when you were in Portland, you studied supply management, right?
Supply chain management. Yeah.
Has that come in handy for you?
Not really, not at all. I've never used it. I think honestly the only reason I wanted to do business school for sure. I was like, that was like something I was like really interested in. But I remember like I already like spent 4 years in med school, and I remember I met with an advisor in business school, and I was like, okay, what is the fastest route out of this? And they're like, we have a new major, supply chain management, like that's thriving now, and it is the shortest way out. And I'm like, that's all I need to hear. Yeah, sign me up.
We're almost having a break here, but it was, as I understand it, you took a public speaking course, and you had a teacher that said, you know, you should think about stand-up.
He did, yeah.
Which is amazing.
After I finished my semester, he actually asked me if I was doing stand-up comedy, and I was like, no, I've never done it. I'm like, I'm a big fan of stand-up, but haven't tried it myself. And he was like, you should definitely try it. And he just like really pushed me into that direction. And then I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. And now I'm doing it full-time, so I'm glad I took his advice.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That is Mohanad El-Sheikhi, and again, talking to us about growing up in Libya. And he lives now in Portland. He is indeed a stand-up comic. In fact, he's here in Philadelphia to do a private performance and joining us on Radio Times. Any questions or comments, you can call our show, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you are still with us or are joining us, our guest is Mohanad El-Sheikhi, and we are talking about his life in comedy. Here's another clip, and this is from the Helium Comedy Club in Portland last year.
Well, also, I saw on the news lately that the school district in Pennsylvania, you want to arm students and protect them by giving them rocks. It's 100% true. You want to arm students and protect them by giving them rocks. And that would work only in one case. Like, if the attacker weapon of choice was, like, scissors. With paper, just kind of f***ed.
Again, another clip by our guest, Mohanad El Sheikhi. And we did Google that, and it is true. It's the yeah. Blue Mountain School District in Schuylkill County, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
So was that just finding something in the news and saying to yourself, holy mackerel?
Yeah, no, I was actually on Twitter, and I saw the headline, and I was like, and that was like the first thing that came to my mind, just like rock, paper, scissors.
Right.
Yeah, and I just like, and I tweeted it immediately, and I was like, oh, this can be a joke. I'll kind of like work on it and write it down.
Well, how do you, I mean, maybe it's an unfair question, so, you know, how do you do what you do? But in terms of creating your comedy, it's very narrative, I would say. I mean, yeah. In many ways, it is storytelling.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's definitely very personal. I do take a lot of, like, from my personal life, and I put that on stage because I feel like people want want to know about you. That's their main thing. They want to, but some of it is just, like, observations, like short, funny observations, like, you read a news article that stands out to you, and it's like different because you don't want to do like, you don't want to like go on with the same topics that everyone is talking about because some of it just gets really boring.
Sure.
Yeah, and people are just like over it. But yeah, I mean, like I just like try and like, I have my phone all the time on me, and if think of something funny or like I'm talking to someone and something funny happens, I just like immediately like get my notes app and just like write like maybe like three words or something just to remember it. Mm-hmm. And then later the day, like I spend at least 2 hours a day just like kind of like with a piece of paper just like writing down stuff. Some of it is just like not funny at all. It's just like me just like free writing trying to get something. And then yeah, and then at night I just go, I usually have like a show or two a night. I try in the middle of my act, after like because they always start with like old stuff,
right,
end with old stuff. In the middle, it's like I try the new stuff, kind of like sandwich them in the middle, and just try them out and see if they work. If they don't work, I kind of rewrite and try again until like it's ready for like stage.
Well, I noticed one where you say, I think you say, you know, you're from Benghazi, kind of waiting, you know, for the audience to react or cheer or or do something.
Yeah,
it's kind of a test joke. It
exactly
seems.
Yeah, I just throw it out there and just wait what I get. Sometimes yeah, it's just like it depends. Sometimes people clap and I'm like, sure. or like that clip, a lady was like, woo, and I was like, nope.
Is there a correct response?
There isn't. Like, it's just like a fun thing for me to. And sometimes I say it, and I'm like, that usually gets a standing ovation. Thank you. You don't need to. Yeah, you don't need to stand. That's
right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Just to kind of to play off of that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes.
So, are you a tough audience for your jokes? I mean, and you know, obviously you have to try them out on yourself to make sure they work. Are you a tough taskmaster?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Like, I have to rely on what other people say to me about my performances and what they think about my jokes, either online or in like after the shows. Because me personally, I'm like really hard on myself. I'm like, I hate every performance.
Do you really?
Yeah, because like every time I watch a video, I'm like, I should have done that. Or I can't believe I'm putting my hand there. Stuff that people do not notice at all. It's just me, like, kind of like, because I know what's going in my head at the moment. But it does help me a lot because I try and record every set that and like listen back to it. And sometimes like I videotape them just to see how I'm doing on stage, because part of it is like not just joke writing, because you can be the best joke writer ever, but if your stage presence is not good, if you're like, sometimes stuff, I have jokes that did okay when I did them like maybe a few years ago, and now I do them with more confidence. I'm like slow it down a bit and all of that, and it works way better than it did before, even though it is the same exact joke written down.
Interesting. But it's about your delivery and
exactly.
Just the kind of cadence, the body language,
absolutely.
All of that put
absolutely.
Together.
Yes.
I mean, it is performing, right? It's
exactly.
Acting. It's an art form.
It is acting, yeah. Because like for me, I'm like my persona on stage, I'm like this like very super confident person, even though that's not how I am in my everyday life. I'm like very anxious and like I think about stuff a lot. I just like talk to myself and whatever. But when I'm on stage, I'm just like, I feel nothing. I'm just like really focused on what I'm doing. I make eye contact with people, which is something I don't do in my real life that
Even
much.
Even though you're making eye contact with me?
I am. Well, that's, yeah, because I'm like, I'm on the show.
What else
now.
Are you going to do, right?
Exactly. But like if I'm walking down the street or like, I'm not really like, or I'm at a party or something. I'm not really like a really social person or something. Yeah, yeah. I'm like, I rather spend my whole day at home just like doing stuff. I don't really, I don't really go out unless I have to or I have a comedy show. Mm-hmm. That's where I feel like the most comfortable. It's just like it's something that you build on stage. Once you find your voice, then that's you, and it doesn't matter what's going on in your day. Once you're on stage, you just go into that persona and just do your performance and just leave.
Do you like that guy? I mean, the guy that you are on stage?
Yeah, absolutely. Because
do you like him better than the other guy that's at home?
Absolutely. I'm like, I wish I was that all the time. Yeah, because people – and it's funny because like people like when I finish my sets and something, they're not sure if you want to talk to me or not, or like because they're like just like intimidated by me, which is very funny to me because I'm like there's nothing to be worried about, you know?
Well, I'm thinking about that teacher that said to you when you were taking the public speaking class, you know, you should consider stand-up comedy. There must have been something, even before you had honed this personality, there must have been something at work then.
Absolutely. I think because my thing is just like I take really tough subjects and try and make them funny. And I do this with my act. Obviously, on YouTube, there's like 5 minutes. My act is like almost an hour. And a lot of it is... is like taking like stuff that people like if I tell you like the topic, I'm like, I don't think that's funny. Like that doesn't seem like a joke. But I try to make it first. I have to connect it to something that people can relate to. And then once I kind of build that like relationship between us, then I can go on and make fun about whatever I want. It's just like, I mean, it's a tough thing because you got to do it over and over again.
Sure.
And test it and stuff like that. But
and
yeah,
every audience is different.
Every audience is different, especially now that I'm doing a lot of traveling. Because
right.
What hits in Portland doesn't hit the same in New York. And I have to kind of adjust and, like, learn my audiences. So my first show in New York, this is, like, me just kind of, like, learning what the audience is like.
And how do you do that?
It's just, like, by reading the room, seeing the comedians who go before me, what the audience react to more. Is it like the body language? Is it like what they say? Are they telling more stories? Are they like more like loud? Are they like slow? That kind of stuff. And then you kind of like and then I go on stage and do my material. I'm like, okay, maybe I need to adjust a bit. Maybe I should say it that way. And sometimes it's the topics, because some topics make sense in the West Coast, some topics don't make any sense here.
Absolutely. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Mohanad Elsheikhi, and he is a stand-up comedian, grew up in Libya. He was telling us a bit about his life growing up in Benghazi. He now lives in Portland and has been traveling around the country doing stand-up comedy and is here in Philadelphia. You can join us again, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. You did a TED Talk, and I thought it was really interesting. It was more serious, I would say.
Absolutely, yeah.
Where you said, you know, people find out I'm from Libya, and they just want to find out about all the horrible things that I have been through in order to survive and to be here, talk about war and trauma. But for you, it seemed that comedy was a way to tell your own story and
absolutely.
Not to have other people tell it for you.
Absolutely.
I found that really interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, because comedy, I'm like, I'm the person with the mic, obviously, and I get to do it on my own terms. Yes, I'm telling my story. I'm sharing it. I'm doing all of that. But I do it the way I like to do it versus like my first year here in like the U.S. and like how people like would the kind of thing I felt like people wanted from me. And the stories that I had to tell, sometimes like even in class or like with professors or something, they just like want to hear about like.
Tell us about the revolution, right?
Or exactly. And sometimes like it is kind of, it felt like when I think about it now, it kind of felt rude when it, like they ask you about like stuff that are like very, very personal, like your feelings and like how it must feel very hard. You must be this, you must be that. I'm like, I don't think you would ask it in any other situation. If like someone gets into like a car accident and can't walk anymore, you can't be like, it must be so bad to not be able to walk ever again. Like, you don't talk to people that way. So it felt like that kind of like people kind of like they disconnect from their human part, and they just want to hear, because to them it's just like it's a story. It's like going to see a movie. You hear about it for an hour and then you don't think about it that much after that. And also, obviously, like, I'm 28, the revolution was probably maybe, or like the war in Libya, it was like only 4 years of my life, and I'm like, there's so much else I'd rather talk about, like, I'd rather talk about, I don't know, true crime, that's a passion of mine.
Oh, interesting, well, you and everybody else, right?
Exactly, yeah, exactly. But yeah, all of that. But with stand up, it's just like I can make fun of it. I can write the jokes. I make fun of me, but I also make fun of people as well. So it's just like kind of like 50-50 kind of thing. So, and it's more fun, and people like remember you differently that way. Yeah.
We live in such fraught political times. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe this is sort of how life is going to be. I do not know the answer to that. But I wonder just sort of how political you want to make your humor, how topical. There's a lot of late night TV comedy shows that are really going at, for instance, the president and others in political office. Does that interest you at all? And you know, you weren't born here, so you might have a slightly different perspective.
Absolutely, yeah. I honestly leave my topical humor to social media mostly. Or yes, I'm obviously very interested in writing for like late night TV to make that like a career of mine, to write it like for someone else to do it or for a show or something. But when it comes to my stand up, I try to kind of like stay away from that. Because people see that on TV all the time, right. and the same topics just go over. Like, there are like maybe 8 or 9 late night TV shows, and sometimes the jokes feel the same. But that's what they do. That's what people tune in for. But if you go on stage and do that again, I'm like, okay, that's funny, but also like I don't like in my whole hour, I don't have a single joke about the president, because I'm like, every joke has been done. And I feel like from context clues, people would know how I feel about him. There's no need for me to go and talk about him. Yeah, and sometimes, like, if it's political, it's something like that joke about, like Pennsylvania.
Right.
Yeah. It's just like
or an easy target. You know?
It has to be something that is just, like, funny. Like anyone from any, like, I feel like with this joke, like, no matter what political party you are, you find it funny, because it's just like something that just feels dumb.
I'm though curious. You are, as I said, you grew up in Libya. I'm assuming you're Muslim.
I mean, I grew up Muslim.
Maybe not practicing.
Exactly. I grew up in a Muslim family. Yeah.
But at the same time, probably seen as Muslim in this country. And
absolutely.
I wonder if absolutely, yeah. That's tough for you.
I mean, it is, because people have a lot of assumptions about like how you are and what you feel and like what your opinions about like specific topics as well. And sometimes you don't get asked about these things. People just make that assumption. And I felt that sometimes, like even like living in Portland, which is like a very liberal city, and obviously like have like a big gay community there and stuff. And people assume that you have specific feelings about that stuff, or like my friends would go like to like a gay bar or something, and they were like, I don't know, do you want to go? And I'm like, why do you think I don't want to go? Of course I want to go and hang out. But it's just like funny, because like people are like, this guy is Muslim, this is how what he feels, and this is, and I'm like, it just like feels funny, because like, are you assuming that I have some kind of bigotry in me, and you're trying to respect that? I'm like, I don't get that.
Oh goodness. Yeah that's
exactly. I'm like, what a like weird way to think about it. Yeah. So, and obviously like, but not just that side. Obviously, you have the other side as well, which is people read my name on social media as Mohamed Al-Sheikhi, and they have all of these assumptions about who I am. And I just get a lot of like on the right, a lot of trolls and a lot of like horrible stuff they say to me and like the stuff they send me. And
what do you do about that or anything?
I for the most part, I just block people. Like, I'm like, I'm not, unless I have something funny to say back to them, it doesn't really bother me at all anymore. Like, they can say whatever they want. It's just like, it went from me being upset and mad about what they say about me or stuff, to me now feeling more sad about them. I'm like, what a horrible life you must be leading, that you're now on the internet harassing someone that you don't know. Like, it just feels very sad.
Because of their name, I guess.
Exactly.
Or the assumptions about what comes with a name like that.
Exactly. Yeah, I was just like saying, like, even like thinking, like being that hateful is just like, what a sad life you must lead. So I just feel sad. Yeah.
Do you get nervous before a performance? Are there certain things you do before doing your stand-up? To prepare yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if it's a different place, if it's a big show, if I feel like if I'm trying new stuff, I do feel nervous, like before the shows and stuff. But I just try to remind myself, like, just have fun. Just people want you to succeed. Right. Like, the audience wants you to do well. I mean, one thing I just do, like, I spend maybe half hour before, I just like pace around, just like go around the club or whatever the place I am. And sometimes I listen to my set just kind of like to prepare. Or I just like write my whole set list down just to have a visual of what I'm doing. And once I do that, like once I see it in front of me, I'm like, okay, I have my whole show here. Like I should be good. It doesn't matter. But yeah, once I'm on stage, that's it. Like I don't feel anything anymore. I don't feel nervous. I'm just ready to go.
You received asylum last fall.
That is correct, yes.
What has that meant to you?
I mean, it was a very big relief to me because I've been waiting for that for over 4 years since I applied in 2014. And it was something that I pushed into the back of my mind. I stopped thinking about it. But it was just like the end of like living in that kind of like limbo. Because before that, it was like, am I going to get approved? Am I not going to get approved? And what will that mean? And like, I have my whole life here. And I was like, I'm not sure what to do if it doesn't get approved. It's just like, there's going to be like a lot of like other like procedures that I have to go through and stuff. But once I got it, I was like, oh my God, like this is such a relief. Now I can just go on with my life, get my green card, travel, do stuff. Yeah.
And do they tell you? I mean, are they, you go to a meeting or you get a letter, or how does one learn one has asylum?
So you do an interview first. And I did mine a year before I got my asylum accepted. And the interview is like probably 3 hours or something, where them just digging into your story, asking you personal details and just going by the timeline, like one thing, and just making sure that you're like, your story like checks out, right, and you are who you are. And I mean, I was like, I've been preparing for this for years now. I've got it down.
Well, Mohanad Elsheikhi, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. And again, stand-up comedian Mohanad Elsheikhi here in Philadelphia to perform tonight. After this very short break, we'll be talking about the trade/tariff war along the U.S.-Mexico border. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Avocados, beer, phones, car parts, these are some of the products the U.S. imports from Mexico, a major trading partner. President Trump told Mexican leaders last week that unless they stop the flow of migrants at the U.S. border, he will impose a 5% tariff on all Mexican imports beginning on Monday and raise it every month until it reaches 25%. Yesterday, the Mexican government reportedly offered to send 6,000 troops to its border with Guatemala as part of the negotiations. Now, the Republican Party is against these tariffs. The stock market has had jitters since the announcement, and most economists oppose raising tariffs, saying it's essentially a tax that American consumers end up paying. While negotiations are ongoing and Trump is known to change his mind without warning or explanation, what would all this mean? We asked Chad Bound to join us. He's the Reginald Jones Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He examines international trade laws and institutions, trade negotiations, and trade disputes. Also the co-host of Trade Talks. That's a weekly podcast on the economics of international trade policy. Chad Bound, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Let me quote something the president said yesterday to Laura Ingraham on Fox News. He said, tariffs are a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful word if you know how to use them properly. Is he using them properly?
Well,
I didn't know where to start, but yeah, we might as well just jump in feet first here.
No, and I think that's the right question to ask. President Trump likes to use tariffs. I think we had recognize that by now. He uses tariffs a lot. He thinks of them as giving him leverage and basically the ability to bully other countries into getting something that he wants. But there is a big downside to that, and that is the economic cost of these things. And so tariffs basically are a tax. It's a tax that's only applied to goods that are made in a foreign country. So whether they're these, you know, Mexican avocados or cars coming in or phones or clothes. But those are ultimately taxes that are going to be paid by, in this case, American consumers. And So, yes, they can be used as leverage, but there are definitely costs associated with these. And the costs, at least the tariffs that have been imposed to date, all of the evidence suggests the costs are being paid by American consumers.
Well, let's talk about how Mexico and the U.S. economy are so intertwined. And even looking at the economy in Texas itself, I don't know if they're our second largest trading partner, but clearly a major trading partner. Things like cars and auto parts crossing the U.S.-Mexico border multiple times. Help us understand this relationship.
Yeah, that's incredibly important. In fact, what's happened with all of the tariffs that President Trump has imposed on China so far, Mexico has now become our largest trading partner. And I think cars, automobiles are the perfect example. So President Trump talks a lot about disliking the fact that Americans buy so many cars that are assembled in Mexico. Now, a lot of these are American car companies or Japanese car companies. And it's true. Mexico does sell a lot of cars to the United States and the American consumer. But it's something like, 30% of the value of cars and other manufactured products that we're buying from Mexico is actually made up of American-produced parts,
wow,
components, engines,
wow,
that we first ship to Mexico. And so if President Trump ends up imposing tariffs and making it more difficult for Americans to be able to buy those products, it's ultimately going to hurt the same Americans that are selling all of the inputs to Mexico in the first place. And that's a big piece of this that I don't think President Trump is taking into consideration.
Use the word bully, using tariffs as a bullying tactic. Now, as we talk, there are negotiations going on. I thought it was interesting that yesterday, the Mexican government said they would send troops to the Guatemalan border. There's some talk about whether they would hold migrants, within Mexico and not allow them into the United States. Would you say these bullying tactics are working?
Well, I'm really not sure. I think we do need to recognize that there is a fundamental crisis going on here that is a very, very difficult set of policy issues to have to address. So we do have what's driving the crisis is not actually immigrants from Mexico. These are largely immigrants coming into Mexico from its southern border with Guatemala that are coming from either Guatemala or other countries in Central America, El Salvador, Honduras, but that are leaving those countries because of violence and instability and insecurity. And so they're coming to the United States to try to get asylum. And because America has shut down, and made it incredibly difficult for illegal migrants to get into the country, the main route that these types of people have to get in now is by claiming asylum, by showing up with, their families and children. By Mexico sending, more troops to their southern border with Guatemala, it could stop or help stop the flow of refugees in migrants, but it is likely to create other problems. It's not as if these Mexican troops were sitting around doing nothing. My understanding is these are the very same folks that are doing other things like fighting drug trafficking and fighting, the illicit drug trade that America is also very worried about. So pushing them to deal with the migrant problem is really ultimately just taking them away from another problem.
This seemed to come, I believe it was a couple of tweets last week coming from the president saying that this is what he wanted to do to stem the flow of migrants coming into the United States. And I wonder whether, and as I mentioned in my introduction, I don't think there's any surprise here, is the president is impulsive. And certainly the Mexico border has been such an important issue for him. But I would think for businesses want predictability. They want to be able to plan into the future. So while we're in negotiations here, what is the impact on businesses broadly speaking?
That is an incredibly important point. So President Trump spent the first 2 years of his administration renegotiating NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, this trade deal between the United States, Canada, and Mexico that he despised, that he ran against in his campaign for president. He renegotiated that thing. And it's right now, it hasn't been signed into law yet. It still has to go through Congress in the United States and in Mexico and Canada as well. But the idea behind that deal was to try to reduce a lot of this uncertainty that faces businesses about potential border barriers to trade. And the concern is, you know, even a country like Mexico that President Trump negotiated and was happy to negotiate a deal with and got one negotiated to completion, he basically now has ripped away all of the benefits of that uncertainty by introducing this threat of tariffs if Mexico doesn't do something else that he wants. So it's making it very difficult if you're a company to know, you know, what markets you're going to have open to you in the future, whether it's the Mexican market, the American market. Should you invest in new plants? Should you train workers to be able to, you know, create products, service products for those markets? It's really difficult now for companies to figure out what President Trump's true intentions here really are.
Well, it seems that his belief in tariffs is that by raising the prices, you would force a company to relocate, let's say, in the United States, so they wouldn't have to pay the tariffs. Is that how business works?
There can be a little bit of that. So there will probably be some relocation, you know, of production back to the United States, just because it's becoming so much more expensive to be able to sell into the United States from you know, almost anywhere else in the world because of President Trump's tariffs. And so mm-hmm. some companies, they're going to have to do that. But there are problems associated with that. The big one is countries are retaliating against U.S. exporters. So if you're a company that doesn't want to just service the U.S. market, you don't want to just sell to American consumers because, you know, 95% of the world's consumers live outside of our borders, you can't. You know, producing in America has actually become a less and less attractive place under President Trump because costs are going up because of his tariffs and because of the retaliation that trading partners are doing.
I was reading, it might have come from the Peterson Institute, looking at that if 25% tariff is imposed on Mexican imports into the United States, that households would pay an average of $900 more per year. Is that correct?
There's a range of estimates out there, but I think that's a good one to go with. And I think, you know, you just have to look at the wide variety of types of products that we buy from Mexico. You know, we do buy a lot of automobiles and trucks. And so those costs will go up. Those prices will go up. We buy a lot of clothing from Mexico. We also buy a lot of agricultural products, you know, avocados. And then there's also the really big concern about retaliation. And Mexico hasn't said anything about retaliation yet. But every other time President Trump has imposed one of his sets of tariffs, the trading partner that's been hurt by this, you know, has ended up retaliating and generating an additional set of costs to Americans.
Well, that's interesting. I'm looking at a story. It was in the Washington Post this morning about Texas, saying in 2018, Texas imported more than $107 billion worth of goods from Mexico. But Texas sent nearly $110 billion of its own products to Mexico, so about $3 billion more sent to Mexico than we get. Is that why people, including Republicans, are so nervous in Texas?
It really is, and that's probably a really good example because because Texas straddles the border there with Mexico. The way that a lot of these industries have set themselves up is as if, at least for them, on a commercial basis, the border with Mexico doesn't really exist. So you can make parts in the United States, sophisticated parts that would go, you know, into an engine of a car or to some fancy electronics products. You can make those in America, the high value added stuff, and ship it over the border, the physical border, into Mexico and have it be assembled there and then sold either back into the United States or exported somewhere else around the world. The really big concern is if you start imposing these tariffs or you create these other bottlenecks at the border, it really is going to impact the ability of companies in Texas and really alongside the border all throughout the Southwest there to be able to operate efficiently. It's gonna kind of muck up their supply chains and make it really difficult for them to continue to sell.
So it's hard to predict this president. I'll preface my question with that, Chad Baum, but how do you see this going? And it seems like today is a critical day. The deadline imposed by the president so far has been Monday. What do you think?
I agree. You don't want to try to predict this president. You know, I think we have to, and I think the Mexican government has to prepare for the worst. They have to prepare for the possibility that there really could be, you know, these new tariffs going into effect on Monday, like President Trump has threatened. I think we can hold out hope that won't be the case. And I think clearly the Mexican government sent a number of high-ranking officials from across very, various government agencies to Washington this week to discuss both the economic issues, the trade issues, the migration issues, the security issues. So they are working really, really hard to try to address this crisis, despite the fact that, you know, a number of the key Trump administration officials weren't in town this week. So President Trump created this crisis and said that he's going to impose tariffs. But a lot of the key government officials that on the American side that one would want to be talking to, you know, aren't even here. So I think there is the risk that this could actually turn into tariffs on Monday.
Is there a time when tariffs do make sense?
Not really.
Really?
Yeah. From this perspective, anytime you want to use a tariff, there's really, regardless of what your objective is, there's really some better policy out there that you could be using that wouldn't generate as many what economists call unintended consequences or kind of bad side effects as a tariff would. When we line up all the different ways that governments can intervene, even in for legitimate reasons, it just turns out that the tariffs really aren't high up on that list.
What would be a better policy then?
Well, if we're thinking about this particular crisis, I mean, the real fundamental underlying issue here is we have to deal with the human insecurity problem and the violence that's taking place in these countries, in El Salvador and Honduras. And so there's crime, there's drugs, but it's also concerns over economic development. The Trump administration has been actually cutting off aid to this region, American assistance to this region, instead of actively engaging to try to help these countries to make it so the conditions are such that, you know, the people actually want to stay and they want to work and they want to have jobs and then want to create new businesses. That's really a much better approach to tackle the underlying problem than try to use tariffs to stop people from coming in.
That's a heavy lift.
It is. It's not an easy problem to solve by any stretch. It really, really isn't. But these are people that we're talking about here, and these are their lives, and this is, you know, their security. And so if we're going to spend, government resources and government money, this is the kind of thing that we should be worrying about.
About a minute or so before we have to say goodbye, and I noticed that the Federal Reserve making some noises about having to maybe cut interest rates to offset whatever tariffs might go into effect. What do you make of that? And is that a good sign or how do we factor all that in?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Federal Reserve is, by and large, just keeping track of the health of the overall U.S. economy. You know, there were new jobs numbers that were released this morning. Right. They were a little lower than was anticipated. But the Fed is looking at the trade war. It's looking at the impact of the tariffs. But it's looking at that in the context of all of the other broader economic indicators that it keeps track of. And ultimately, once it takes all of those into consideration, our hope is that, you know, they'll adjust their policies, the policy tools that they have at their disposal accordingly.
And is the stock market a good barometer for economic health?
I'm not really of that view. It is definitely for some. It's definitely, you know, one of the things to worry about and to look at, but it's one of many.
Well, on that note, Chad Bown, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And again, he's the Reginald Jones Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, co-host of a weekly podcast called Trade Talks. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. And you can find out more about the program, download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.